This is Mark Steiner. There was a New York Times Sunday Review piece that really caught my attention in the opinion pages, and it was written by Walter Dean Myers, one of our celebrated children's writers in this country. And the title of the piece, which we'll attach to our website here, is Where Are the People of Color in Children's Books? And I immediately got into a conversation over their email with Charles Johnson, of course, the National Book Award winning novelist of Middle Passage and much more, about this, because he's put together a book, a children's book called Bending Time, The Adventures of Emory Jones, Boy Science Wonder, which we've talked about on the air here before. And we put together this really interesting panel to kind of wrestle with what this means. And Dr. Charles Johnson joins us, as well as Tanya Bolden, who's an award-winning author of over 20 books for young adults. Her newest book is Searching for Sarah Rector, The Richest Black Girl in America, about the life of Sarah Rector, the making of Oklahoma and the establishment of black towns. And her book, 33 Things Every Girl Should Know About Women's History, was an American Library Association best book for young adults. And speaking of library associations, we have with us Deborah Taylor, who is School and Student Services Coordinator for the Enoch Pratt Free Library here in Baltimore, Maryland, and is one of our leading experts on children's literature. Good to have the three of you with us.
It's great to be
Thank
here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
So, Charles, let me start with you, because we began this conversation by email after that piece came out. And it was really stark and striking to me because, as I said to Deborah Taylor before the show started, I had no idea. I mean, because if you live in a semi-cloistered world, and we all of us do in some aspects of our lives, you look at the books in your children's library or you look at the books that you pull out normally because you want people to look at and read and share, and you feel like there are a lot of black books out there, but then clearly not.
Well, clearly not, and the ones that are there, as Walter Dean Myers points out, seem to fall into the category of stories about either slavery or the era of segregation. You know, I've written a lot of those stories myself over the years, but I'm very new, and my daughter, Elishaba, is very new to writing children's literature. But what we both felt very strongly about is that she has a two-year-old son, my grandson, and we wanted a story that would inspire him, that would get him excited specifically about STEM education. Science, technology, engineering, and math, that those were his possibilities. And for 30 years, I've been carrying around in my head the idea of a 10-year-old black child prodigy. They don't exist in our literature as far as I know. A scientific whiz kid who just happens to be black and has these adventures that are fun. And he's fun. And he's got an IQ of 188. I've never encountered stories like that. For example, when I was growing up. Now, we're going to talk about the Walter Dean Myers piece, Where Are the People of Color in Children's Literature? And I deeply admire the work of Mr. Myers, but there's an accompanying piece by Christopher Myers,
right,
which is called The Apartheid of Children's Literature. And he's got a sentence in here that I've been reading it over and over again this morning. He says, children of color remain outside the boundaries of imagination. Now, think about that for a minute. All of us, even as adults, tell stories about ourselves to ourselves. Well, we organize our lives in terms of narratives. And for children, this is so important. The stories that you're exposed to when you're young can stay with you for the rest of your life and shape your aspirations. I think this is one of the most important subjects that we could be talking about right now for our children and our grandchildren.
And let's pick up on this, Tanya, you can jump in here with this, and Deborah as well. I mean, what you just read, Charles, I mean, that idea, children of color remain outside the boundaries of imagination, that doesn't just affect children of color. It affects all children, because it becomes just the white children who can have this.
Yeah. Do we ask ourselves the question, do black boys and girls dream? And our stories are the ones that fertilize their dreams.
I think that is so critical, such a critical point, because if you also look at the books that are available once children begin to learn to read, not just the picture books, but also the books that are the chapter books, when they get to read the books that really kind of determine whether they're going to continue to be readers, we also see a devastating lack in that group of books as well. You can find 2, maybe 3 books when you get to middle grade novels, but when you look at the beginning to read books that those are the books kids have to read lots and lots of to get proficient. There are very few books about where kids will see themselves and then begin to see themselves as readers. So they don't even have a chance to be fertilized because there are so few opportunities to use to have the practice books reflect their lives.
I mean, there's so many reasons about why this is happening. I mean, when I looked at the study, there was a study done that I was attached to one of the articles that about this from Carlines Magazine from the Cooperative Children's Book Center. And when you look at the numbers, the numbers are pretty stunning. You know, in 2002, when they first looked at children's books by and about people of color published in the United States since 2002, 69 authors were African American. Now it's 67 in the year 2013. In between years, it jumped to 100 in certain years and less. And of the books published, they are incredibly low. I mean, 18 out of 2,500 in 1985, 1993, 74 out of 4,500. So, I mean, so one of the things also, the article you referred to a moment ago, Charles, by Chris Myers, he wrote, "What's the problem?" And he said, "Who's the villain?"
Yeah.
And he writes, "The closest I can get to the orchestrator of the plot, my villain with this ferret is the market," which I think is at the point because the market is so comfortable, is so comfortably intangible that no one is worried I will go knocking down any doors, he goes on to say. But so the question becomes the market saying that white kids won't buy black books.
Yeah.
Well, you know, too, I think it's all – I just wanted to back up and say on that number of 67 or 69, that's sometimes that's not 67 or 69 individuals because sometimes, like, Walter and I will have two or three books come out in the same year.
Mm. That's true. That's interesting. Yes, right.
So that may be 40 people.
Right.
But on the market, I had an experience a few years ago at a wonderful literary festival, and one of my colleagues, a white writer who does fabulous books, you know, she was to my right, and a white woman, an educator, came up, and I saw her buy some of great writers' books about white historical figures, important books, and I just glanced up. I wasn't accusing the woman of anything, and she just said to me, "Oh, these books are for my children, but I'm going to buy your books for my school because your books are perfect for those children."
Mm.
Oh, God.
And so, you know, what I'm thinking, wait a minute, black children need to know about Eleanor Roosevelt, and white children and Asian children need to know about George Washington Carver. But children, because it's American history.
And if you take it one step further, when speaking of the market, what I have noticed is how are these books promoted? Other than being trotted out for a special ad in leading up to February, that, or maybe even occasionally included in some back-to-school promotions, where are these books being promoted? They're very seldom do, when you look at how much is the publicity budget for some of these books, very seldom do books about and by African Americans get any promotion. I have reviewed books. I have given books, deservedly so, written by black authors, great reviews. I have never seen those reviews, you know, a quote from those reviews used to promote that book or get that in the hands of any kid. So then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, nobody finds these books, nobody buys these books, therefore we don't need to publish anymore. So if you're speaking about the market, it's not just these books are left to find their own audience for the most part. And if they don't, that's used as an excuse not to publish anymore.
Well, you know, when I entered the field, I guess over 20 years ago, there were articles. There was one in the Village Voice by James Ledbetter, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The Unbearable Whiteness of Publishing. Mm. And back then, people were talking.
I never heard that.
That was the title.
The Unbearable Whiteness of Publishing.
The Unbearable Whiteness of Publishing. Village Voice.
Uh huh.
But then there was always talk about how the major publishers, you know, don't know how to reach black book buyer, and I guess there was supposed to be work that was going to be done on that. But this is 20 years, 30 years later, and not much has really changed.
Tanya, let me kind of tag on to that if I can.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I think this problem that we're talking about with children's literature is symptomatic of a larger cultural problem. Mm-hmm. In Walter Dean Myers' piece, toward the very end, he references Jill Morton, the actor who starred in The Brother from Another Planet,
right.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about movies, not talking about books, but he's saying that there's a similarity going on here. And we have to think about, you know, if someone has a problem with the image of a black child on the cover of a book, Mm-hmm. Think about the way movies are marketed. How many black actors carry a movie? They're usually background characters. And we're told in the movie business, that half of the money, comes from Asia to fund these things. And people like to look at white protagonists and white characters. And they don't mind having a couple, who show up like, Denzel Washington, or maybe Will Smith, because they're not, the word is they're not really seen as being black. But we have a problem here with the American imagination in which the whites are the standard by which all others are judged. And they're at the center of almost all of our narratives and stories in terms of, and it's saying to the kids, these are the only stories that are important. These are the only lives and histories that are important. This is a deep problem. And I think, it touches children's literature, but it touches other areas as well.
Indeed. There's certain areas where it's okay to have a black face in basketball. Mm-hmm. It's okay to have a black face in music. Mm-hmm. All of the folks who are averse to buying a book with a black character on the cover for their children have no problem having the picture of Jay-Z pop up on their download.
No.
So there are certain places where you are allowed to be, but...
And you could add sports and athletics to that.
That's right. But those places.
But even with sports and athletics, we're still talking about the entertainment.
Exactly.
Right? We're not talking about black scientists. And, President Obama and his Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, they have been trying to hit this really hard, I think, in the last couple of years to communicate the importance of inspiring our kids, in the sciences, for example. The show Cosmos, I would hope would do something along that line. Mm-hmm. With Neil deGrasse Tyson, being its host, saying to kids, black kids do science.
Yeah, and also to add on to that, when we look at what America looks like now, there are a lot of people of color.
40% of the kids I read in one of these articles are either black or Latino.
In our schools today, right?
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
When these two articles appeared, of course, all of us in the children's book world began to immediately post them everywhere we knew. Facebook, everybody was tweeting them back and forth. And we heard from all of our other folks in the field, from Native Americans to Latino folks who care about all kinds of kids, who care about all kids, but from various backgrounds and cultures. We're all saying the same thing. What can we do? And, how do we break this particular cycle that the books don't get published, people don't look for them because they know they're not out there, and then the publishers say, well, nobody buys them.
Go
ahead.
I was going to say, while we are waiting for publishers to get better at marketing books by people of color, one thing all people who are progressive and concerned about all of our children can simply buy more books.
I think that's absolutely true. I've just in the last, since we've been having this discussion, there is a CCBC, the same folks who did the study, who tracked the numbers. They have an ongoing discussion. And actually, as it turns out, 2 or 3 weeks before the articles appeared, they had been having just an online discussion about diversity or the lack thereof in children's books. And there was that whole discussion about being very intentional. And the fact that every time you buy a book, where you buy it from and what the book is a political act. And I found myself like I needed to buy some more books, buying books, but I had to order them. They were not the books sitting on the shelf at the bookstore I went to, the independent in-town bookstore that I went to.
What were you looking for?
I was looking for a new retelling of Beauty and the Beast by an incredible illustrator, Pat Cummings, who has been around for a long time. She hadn't illustrated anything recently, but I had read that she was having a new book, so I had to order that one. And then a new book about a biracial kid by Brenda Woods, and of course the title escapes me right now. But I had to go, I went out deliberately to purchase, which meant no discount, no free shipping, you got to get in your car, you got to go pick it up, book. Because you do become aware that if you don't, if you care about it and you don't make an effort, nobody else is going to do it. Of course, that's
exactly
a drop in the bucket.
And, you know, long gone are the days when, you know, publishers were idealistic people with trust funds.
Well, they're very risk-averse right now, and we're books about people of color is considered a risk.
Well, let me ask this question. I mean, so you're talking about the – I just looked it up. It's The Blossoming Universe of Violet Diamond.
Thank you. That's the title.
That you were talking about. There was one thing you said, Deborah, before you started this conversation, and let's explore from this angle for a moment. You were talking about the pervasiveness – in American culture, of black culture defining American culture. It's coming that increasingly that's becoming the case on a number of levels. But this, and again, it's a lot of sports and entertainment, music, that. But the parts that affect the consciousness of young people, consciousness of the nation, like this, are not being are not being promoted. So the question is why? I mean, what is it? And what does that say about what the future psyche of American culture will be? Because we talk about institutional racism being the basis for a lot of this stuff happening. Well, institutions are made of human beings, and their consciousness is created by the human beings that are in them, right? Even the unconsciousness of it. So we got to take a short break. We'll come back to talk about why are there not more books by people of color in children's literature. Don't go away. On the way to break, you're going to hear Tears in Heaven, Eric Clapton. He wrote this song when his four-year-old son, Connor, fell four stories to his death in an open window in 1991 and wrote this very powerful piece, Tears in Heaven. Beatles, the ballad of John and Yoko, and John Lennon on this day married Yoko Ono, Japanese avant-garde artist, bring you John and Yoko. Welcome back. We are going to pick up where we left off. We're here with Deborah Taylor, School and Student Services Coordinator, the Enoch Pratfrey Library in Baltimore. Tanya Bolden is an award-winning author of children's books. Our latest book is Searching for Sarah Rector, The Richest Black Girl in America. Dr. Charles Johnson, National Book Award-winning novelist and scholar, wrote The Middle Passage and much more. His latest piece is he did with his daughter, El Sheba, which is Bending Time, The Adventures of Emory Jones, Boy Science Wonder, which we did a program about it with him just a little bit ago. And so, but so going back to the question of culture in America and what it means why we cannot break through on this level, but what it means, but how important it is to break through on this level, Deborah.
I think Tanya really kind of gave us a way of thinking about this when she gave the example of someone who is purchasing books and has categorized what books are for her own children and what books are for the children. I'm supposing children of color that she might work with in a school.
Because they need to see black characters, but nobody else does.
Exactly.
Right.
And then you have, so you have people who kind of, you have that issue. Then you have the issue, sometimes well-meaning African-Americans, educators, librarians, who feel that we have to tell that up from slavery story over mm-hmm. and over and over again. And so they want us to know our history. But there is a developmental aspect to children and their reading when they want to read outside of themselves, even as they see themselves. They want to see themselves, but doing different things.
That's an extraordinarily important point. Over the last 30 or 40 years, I've written a lot of stories about slavery. You know, we get into these trends after Roots in the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. PBS did a ton of stories about the slave experience. Not only that was really very valuable, and I think we're in that cycle now with 12 years of a slave, but we need to really think about, you know, opening up the imagination of our children. I'd like to pose a question to both Deborah and to Tanya. My daughter, every night when she gets home from work, reads three stories to her son, my grandpa, and she's reading, I think, Emory Jones a couple of times. She has a broad, you know, range of stories that she reads to him. So here's my question. Do we need to be better readers?
Hmm.
Well, I think, yes, I think all Americans need to be. And that's the other piece of this. Is that, I mean, haven't there been recent studies that we're sort of anti-intellectual?
Yes. Well, I mean, one out of five people is functionally illiterate. Cannot read, for example, a medicine bottle and understand the instructions on it, or read a newspaper op-ed and be, and we're talking about some college students as well, read a newspaper op-ed and tell you what the argument is being presented by the writer.
And I think also when it's so much easier for people to reach for something, and I am a person who loves her devices as much as the next person, but it's so much easier to plonk kids down in front of a screen, which we know doesn't necessarily ensure that they're going to become the kinds of readers that we want them to be. We also have to realize that we will often say, well, nobody read to me and I turned out all right. Well, we live in a vastly different world than even the world that I grew up in, where I could read books because there wasn't really much else to take to interest me and to keep me engaged.
Mm-hmm.
There was not a two or three or four other screens in the same room to keep me engaged. So we know that we need to ensure that our kids have such a variety of experiences through the books. And that's where I agree with you. We need to be better readers. We also need to encourage people to tell their own stories. Nobody read to me when I was a kid, but my grandmother told me stories. And I learned the story arc, a beginning and a middle and an end. And so then the next step for me was to find it in a book. So, but now we think we talk to our children. We mostly direct them. We don't really talk to them and give them story and a sense of story. So I think that is really important. We need to be better readers. We need to be better communicators with our kids and to make sure that they can see the bigger picture of narrative. And I think that's missing in a lot of people.
You know, recently during a school visit, I forget how I got to this, but I was talking to kids and I asked them, do they write letters to one another or to thank you notes? The art of writing we're losing. But back to reading, what I've noticed in the last 10 years is that a book that I wrote for a 10-year-old is being read by a 14-year-old. A middle grade novel I did a program for high school students.
Is this because kids are not reading at grade level now?
Yeah.
And they have really a tough time with comprehension. Even because we focus so much on the mechanics in order to be able to test, that it has really resulted in kids really having a tough time understanding what they've read. They, even if we can, because we figured out maybe how to drill and get them to be able to decode, but they don't understand. Search for meaning is really much more critical. So the reading comprehension aspect is something that makes it difficult. But part of that is a lack of practice. That is only way you get to be a good reader is to practice. And very few reading instructional programs include practice. They assume that you're going to take your book home and practice. Yeah, as opposed to those four screens in the room.
But it also,
and, you know, also modeling a few years ago on the same subject, someone said that, you know, was sort of children don't read any. And I said, how many children see adults sitting somewhere quiet and reading a book?
I think Walter, even in his article, he even makes a reference to sitting with his stepmom in their Harlem apartment and watched as she was reading true romance books.
Right.
He estimates she was reading at third grade level.
Right.
Exactly. But she knew, she got her entertainment from reading those true romances as opposed to just getting the story from a screen.
Yeah.
You know, as I've often said, you know, there's a lost picture of me, maybe two or three, and my parents' bed with my mother's glasses sort of lopsided on my face and a book upside down. My parents, neither of them had a lot of formal schooling, but they were readers.
One of the things that I was thinking about, that we had a conversation here about a month ago with M.K. Asante, and one of the things he was saying was what he realized with his peers and going to school and is that there's a lack of comprehension because people aren't reading. If you don't know language, you can't think beyond simple ideas and can't kind of tear things apart and come up with what's really being said. just to it, you know, not being able to take an opinion page and really discuss what it means or analyze what it means after you've read it is because we don't allow that to happen in our schools anymore. That's not what we're teaching. And technology feeds into that because you're reading less, because you're only reading short pieces. Everybody's reading less. They want it quick and out and you're done.
That's right.
You know, I mean, that's part of the issue in a larger societal sense.
I think that it's really clear that we are wanting everything kind of fed to us and boiled down. We don't really want to do that kind of work where you're reading something, really stopping, thinking about it, trying to put it in context, trying to understand and get to the real crux of the matter of whatever it is that you're reading. It's going to be so interesting because you see all of this discussion about the new Common Core standards,
right,
and how it implies that kids are going to be doing deep reading. Well, how are they being prepared to be able to do that kind of reading?
And just to come back to the original thing we were talking about in the beginning here, I was thinking also of the piece that you were talking about, Charles Johnson, that Chris Myers wrote on the apartheid of children's literature. And let me just read this one piece he wrote here, which I think is very critical to kind of the future of where society is going as a whole, because this is not just – it is about young children of color seeing themselves in all kinds of roles to expand the imagination and creativity, which we'll come back to, because I think that's critical. But he also wrote – this is a quote from the article he wrote. Books transmit values. They explore our common humanity. What is the message when some children are not represented in those books? Where are the future white personnel managers going to get their ideas of people of color? Where are the future white loan officers and future white politicians going to get their knowledge of people of color? Where are black children going to get a sense of who they are and what they can be?
Well, Mark, Walter Dean Myers makes the same point. He talks about working at a place where they were hiring a chemist.
Exactly.
Right. He says, my white coworker had simply never encountered a black chemist before, or a black engineer, or a black doctor. You know, with the images that we present to the world are so extremely important. You know, we still live in a fairly segregated, society. About 80%, I think, of white Americans live in communities where they don't really come across, you know, people of color. They've never seen a black scientist. You know, there was a wonderful program that I sent around a link to. Quite recently to friends, I came across by accident. It was about a woman named Katherine Johnson, a mathematician. Mm. And what she was quite a mathematician. She worked at NASA, and all of those flights into orbit, she calculated. She did the calculations for the rockets going up and all of that. And John Glenn, you know, by the time he was coming around, they had computers. And they calculated his flight that way. But then he said, I want her, Katherine Johnson, to check it. She said she spent a day and a half going over the numbers mm-hmm. and got the same numbers as the computer. Now, back in that day, we're talking the 50s and 60s, they had a room full of women, and they were called women computers. They did all of the math, calculating. So, you know, she could say to John Glenn, well, if you go up in this thing, you can be assured that by the time you get to this point, the moon will, in fact, be there. You know, so how come we didn't hear about her or see her in the right stuff?
Well, also too, why today do we still have to tell our girls you can do science, you can do math?
And why didn't we see it? I mean, this is part of the whole question of defining culture and how it gets defined. Why didn't we see that? So how do you push those questions?
I think we go back to the market. Because if you have certain booksellers, book buyers, who only understand the black experience in terms of slavery and Jim Crow, if they will only buy those books, then the publishers will be more inclined to publish those same stories over and over.
And I think as there's not as much money for materials in schools and libraries, which are more likely, not always, but more likely, to try to have a broader array of subjects and stories, then the publishers feel that they have to rely more and more on the individual purchaser. And if they are not getting, you know, the numbers of books purchased through schools that we had when we had the early years of the Elementary and Secondary School Act, when so many school libraries were first built and outfitted, they are going to go back to the stories that they feel sell. So over and over again, we'll get the Twilight ripoffs, or we'll get the Hunger Games ripoffs, or we'll get, you know, we'll get wizards with private tutors as opposed to wizards going to school to show how different they are. So the publishers are not going to try to be, they're not going to be creative in terms of what they do. They're going to follow what they feel is already selling.
Because it's a business. I'm going back to what you, what Charles started in the very beginning of this conversation, when we talked about children of color remaining outside the boundaries of imagination and what that does to our society and what it does to the, to children of color. But what are some of the responses to that? You know, when you think about this, sometimes the response has to do with creating conversations like this so that people are even aware that we're, that this exists. Because school systems are the ones who purchase books for children to read.
Right.
If most urban area, and I don't just mean schools where mostly black and brown kids go, but if schools were saying we want literature where everybody's included in these stories about science, about this, whatever the subject is, I mean, something has to begin to change it, because the school books are like a, they were a billion-dollar industry. Now they're, it's all around testing, but I mean,
right.
That's part of the problem. But that is, something has to happen to kind of change that conversation. People to realize, I don't think people even realize this is going on. It's not in the consciousness.
I taught children's literature at a local university for about three or four semesters. And they were very intentional about including in the – we had a required children's literature course. And they were very intentional that the folks who were being trained to be teachers had to have a multicultural unit as part of that class. But it was not easy to get the students to buy into it. They knew they had to do it, but they thought, well – can we say that disabled is the same as multicultural? Can we say that, you know, they really tried to reach, to include something. They were not comfortable themselves reading outside of their own culture. And we tried to make the point that as early as we could introduce all kinds of people's stories to our children, the more comfortable all children would be with reading stories outside of themselves. So you really do have to work it on so many fronts, from educating the educators to working with parents to getting people to tell more and varied stories to getting people to purchase more and to get people to find a way to market those stories.
You know what the last line is of Walter Dean Myers' piece? There is work to be done.
Exactly.
And
on all fronts.
I feel like I've been working it for a very long time, but
I think that that is part of this conversation you have to have. These are the kind of questions people need to be asked when they are running our school systems and running our worlds, and people who and just push these things in more articles. I mean, to have an article like this published in the New York Times means that some people begin to think about what this means, and we're making and is kind of a chink in the armor, not so much of resistance, but of not knowing, of being just so unaware. It's like Woody Allen. If you watch a Woody Allen movie, I think he's a brilliant filmmaker. I love his movies. I laugh at his movies. If you watch Woody Allen, you think there was not a black person or Latino person living in any of New York City.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or London or Paris or anywhere else he sets a movie.
So, but I don't think that's kind of his saying, I don't want black people in my movie.
He's telling his story.
And he doesn't, it's totally out of his consciousness in some ways.
Yeah, well, I mean, Mark, you're not excusing it, but. Yeah, you just nailed a very common problem in terms of our artistic representations in fiction, in film, in television. No, television can be a little bit better in terms of diversity, I think, although I don't watch much of it.
Right.
But in terms of Woody Allen, why do you think that's the case, Mark?
I think people live in their completely narrow worlds and have no relationships outside that world.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think? What do you think, Charles? Is something deeper?
Well, you know, I think the kids of color in this country have to grow up in a sense biculturally.
Yes.
If you're reading Robin Hood stories,
yes,
like Myers talks about, you're reading all these stories about white characters, Balzac and the rest, you're doing a kind of translation in your own mind, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm,
the characters are white, but you know, you're understanding the story, you understand the plot, you understand the meaning, although there are no black characters in those stories. And we begin to do that very early in our lives. So it's almost like you're bilingual or bicultural, right?
Yeah,
so we have to,
be.
As kids of color,
case,
we grow up with that.
Well, great.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
I'm saying from 7th to 12th grade, I went to a predominantly white private school, and then I went to a predominantly white university. I mean, I had to be bicultural, bilingual, in a sense, to function.
That's right. You know, and this is true for anybody living in a culture that where the other is predominant. If you, I mean, I imagine there would be white Americans who would find themselves in Japan, you know, going to school, and they're going to have to do the same translation from one experience to their own experience. I happen to think, you know, that leads to a kind of subtlety in the consciousness of black kids. If they don't feel so alienated by the material that they just shut down the way Walter Dean Myers said he did, he just stopped reading, you know, because he books were his
right.
friends, but then by the time he got to his teens, he said, well, I don't see myself there. Well, you know, in your case, Tanya, in my case, and I'm sure in Deborah's case, we're always doing this translation so we can enjoy films and books that have white protagonists. But it doesn't work the other way around very often, where white characters, you know, feel that, well, this is a story that speaks to me, even though we have black protagonists and characters in it. You know, we're having this trouble understanding the humanity of people of color.
And I think that in a reverse kind of way, very often when we keep the books to certain historical topics, it keeps people from seeing the full humanity of black folks.
Mm-hmm.
There is a writer that I enjoy very much, Angela Johnson. She won the MacArthur Award. She's an incredible writer. She's written for children and YAs. And very often her characters... The issue of race is there, but it's not the predominant issue. She's dealing with family. She's dealing with family communications. She's dealing with grief. She's dealing with betrayal. She's dealing with, you know, coping with all kinds of human emotions. They become front and center of her novels.
Mm-hmm.
Yet very few people promote her. They don't promote those kinds of stories. When we're, you know, YA literature has become huge. And in many cases, books about kids of color have been left behind. They've not been blogged and talked about and grabbed up for the big movie, adaptations. So I think what has happened is that people have said, oh, yes, we want to have those stories, but only the stories that are about that unique experience of so-called unique experience of slavery coming through Jim Crow. Not that you are a regular human being who is coping with a little brother who has autism. You know, not those kinds of stories. Those are all our stories and not your stories.
And then also, you know, with nonfiction, sometimes it's the quality of the storytelling.
Right.
You know, for example, you know, some people will just, you know, think MLK was only about civil rights. George Washington Carver was only concerned about yams and peanuts. When my book Maricha came out about a 19th century New York girl, in the beginning I had to tell people over and over it's a true story because people couldn't imagine, first of all, black people in the 19th century who were not enslaved and black people who also were middle income.
Remember when you came to Pratt, Tanya, and you talked about that book and the kids were just wide-eyed. And they said, remember they came to you, they said, we didn't know that there was anybody who wasn't enslaved at that time.
Yeah.
And these were sixth graders. These were not tiny little kids. They'd had some U.S. history, but they had no idea of the range of experience that black people had in this country.
And adults as well. It was still like, this is a real story? This is, you know, so, like you said, because the narrative is that all people of African descent were enslaved.
And I think it's so critical right now because now that we're such a culture that it's built on imagery. You know, it's one thing we had to make that translation as children. We'd read all of these stories and imagine them in our minds of ourselves and read ourselves into those stories. But now we have young people who have grown up full of images, and images are everywhere. And if you don't see yourself or you see yourself in only certain places in terms of the images, then that becomes your reality. So, there was another piece that Christopher Myers wrote some months ago that was in Hornbook, which is kind of the publication that librarians and teachers and children's literature folks read. And he talks about, you know, that whole issue after the Zimmerman verdict when where there was the whole discussion about the hoodie. And Chris talked about in his article, what if your vision of the child in the hoodie comes from Snowy Day? You know, Peter in A Snowy Day, which was the, you know, one of the first picture books with a child of color, as opposed to the imagery that we see on our screens now. And so that's one of the reasons these books are so important in not just forming the images that that black children have of themselves, but the images that others have of them. It is so critical that they be seen in the full range of their humanity.
And speaking of images, I work hard at this in nonfiction, is that if I am dealing with slavery in America, I choose carefully the images of enslaved people that I use. Because that's what happens. Sometimes people who aren't thinking, they'll put in images that just is so, that it's going to embarrass a black child, especially. Images of people who were enslaved, but they, you know, I try to find ones where people, you see their humanity, you see dignity, you see hope.
And I think I think that's so important. As an adult, there is no image of African Americans in slavery that would embarrass me. But I do recognize that children have a different sensibility and sensitivity to that. So I think that that's critical what you just said, Tanya.
Charles, you about to say something?
No, I'm just in agreement with everything that Deborah and Tanya are saying.
I think that. And this is really critical, but what has to be pushed here is the images, because the idea of the images that children and adults see, especially children, are what will form the foundation of how they view the rest of the world as they get older.
Very much so.
And what they, and you know, and I was thinking about the show we did the other day around hip-hop and violence, and we had some artists and writers on. We're around this area, and one of the things I've noticed was, we talked about it, I said, you know, I've not seen a hip-hop song about Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Mm-hmm.
You have this about entrepreneurs owning chicken joints, owning this, owning that. What about being an astronomer? What about being an astrophysicist? What about being something that's not even thought about by most people? And that, but the world of literature and stuff can play that role, you know, by putting it out there. And I think sometimes what we need to do is it has to be done in kind of very normal, natural forms. It has to be done with just a story that's part of a story.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think that's why having those stories that are not just where race is the front and center, where you really focus on someone working through being a human being, is so critical at every stage of a child's development.
Well, you know, at Washington Lee University, Provost Mark Connor had a group of people read The Adventures of Emory Jones, Boy Science Wonder, and he shared with me some of the thoughts that they had. But there was one woman who was there. She's a kind of specialist in children's literature, and she said she, if it had not been for the illustrations in the book, which I did, she would not have known the characters were black. The story is about bullying. It's about friendship, you know, and a number of other issues. So the characters are black, and we sort of understand that, but they are human. And they, just as well as white characters, can become the vehicle for the exploration of experiences that anybody could have.
And I think one of the things that you have to hope for is that when someone is putting together a list of books about kids that are having adventures, which, you know, librarians love to make lists, that they would just include, it wouldn't be included for the, you know, the books about black kids, it would just be included about books of adventure.
Yeah.
And that's what you hope for.
Right.
That's
right.
What you hope for. And so that kids get to choose. And then when teachers hold up books to talk about and recommend, or librarians do, that's the important part that they tell. He has adventures. He's learning. He's exploring. He's brilliant. That's what you try to get people to do. It's very tough to break out of the socialization that so many of us have grown up with, about who gets to have an adventure, whose story is being told with that kind of verve and vigor that is going to keep kids reading.
Mm-hmm.
So I think go ahead.
There was an issue a few years ago about, in fiction, books about people of color, but when it came to the jacket, there were some issues.
Oh, that has been a big issue. In fact, one illustrator who wrote a, one author, Justine Labastier, wrote a book called Liar, And she had to take it to social media to get the publisher to back off from putting a picture of a white girl on the cover of the book, because she said that's not who the character is. And they went round and round, and she took it to social media, and they finally backed off, and they put a biracial kid on the cover. But that is a big issue. There, when Bud Not Buddy won the Newbery, and for a big chunk of time, the paperback cover just showed his legs and the suitcase, not his face.
Well, I think maybe one of the things we have to do is take this conversation on the road and take the American Publishers Association and start wrestling with it in a large arena so people can actually deal with this. So maybe this is the beginning of something we can start here in our own small way, because this is how we change things. This is the beginning of how I think consciousness begins to change in America, and you got to push this quote-unquote market to do the right thing. And I just want to thank the three of you. This has been a great discussion, really great discussion. Dr. Charles Johnson, National Book Award-winning author, novelist, scholar. His latest piece, Bending Time, The Adventures of Emory Jones, Boy Science Wonder, which we will attach to on our website. Every day I look for his updates by email all the time to see what's next with Emory. Tanya Bolden, who is an award-winning author for young people, Searching for Sarah Rector, The Richest Black Girl in America, and Deborah Taylor, School and Student Services Coordinator for Enoch Pratt Free Library in Baltimore, all joining us here today to reflect on the piece, Where Are the People of Color in Children's Books, by Walter Dean Myers. It was in the March 15th edition of the Sunday Review in the New York Times. Thank the three of you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much. As Walter said, there is work to be done.
Yes, there is.
Work to be done. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, we're going to talk about an amazing new documentary called Live Young Blood, about the struggle to stop youth violence in Baltimore. So don't go away. Stay with us. On our way to break, we'll hear Soul Fire by Lee Scratch Perry, born on this day in 1936.
Soul Fire!